is the Greenlian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Greenlian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From the snowy landscape above Appalachia, where it looks like the frozen land of Hoth, that's right, I am Micah Hanks, snowed in the bunker. And this, of course, is the Greenlian Report. Glad, as always, to be able to be with you guys, keeping you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe, via KGRARadio.com. Let's lock in and get right to business. Yeah, some hardcore winter prep has been going on here. I don't know if all of you guys follow weather in the Southeast, but it was Snowpocalypse 2018 this weekend. Intermittent power outages and, of course, a lot of winter prep. We're going to talk a little more about that here in a moment. Also, will cryogenically frozen people ever be revived? The haunting sounds of Mars. And also some interesting things that have been happening out there over the Southwest. In fact, some have said that the night sky was, well, it looked kind of like a conga line of military jets. We'll talk more about what was going on and why they were there. And then in hour two, speaking of strange things in the skies, if there's one contentious subject that has been discussed over the years in ufology, which in truth may or may not even be related to the aforementioned subject, that is cattle mutilations. What is really going on? Is this something that can be very simply explained, or is there more here than meets the eye? I was recently reviewing some FBI documents on that subject, and I want to share my own thoughts with you about that. And, of course, everything else that's been on my mind lately while being snowed in over the weekend. That's the great thing about the wintertime. If you don't lose power, of course. But that's something I had to prepare for as well. We had this sudden alert come together. Guys, it's looking like there's going to be some snow. Prepare yourselves. 20 inches in some parts of Western North Carolina. And so, of course, every family member of mine was calling and they were worried. My Seven Ages team, they were also concerned about this because we had a big interview over the weekend that we were prepping for in advance of some big stuff we're going to be doing in January. And if you've got a big interview planned, you don't want to lose power because you won't be able to do the interview. And so I was truly in maverick podcasting mode over the weekend because not only was I buying food, I was also buying candles. I was buying extension cables. I was filling up gas cans and, of course, filling up the tank in my car because this was the general plan. And usually I don't lose power. We used to have some problems in the bunker. And I actually got the power company out here, had them look at things. And now there have been instances where in my general area, people will lose power and I don't. And they'll be calling over here saying, "We see lights on over there at the shack, the elevator shack that leads down to your bunker. Have you got power or is there a generator down there?" No, I've got power. But in case I do lose it, because you never know what's going to happen in the wintertime, if you live in the mountains, it's a forested area right around here. If trees go down and they take down power lines with them, or if a transformer blows somewhere, yeah, you're going to lose power. So I have one of those 12-volt adapters in my car. And, you know, you can get one of these things for less than $20, usually less than $10 at a hardware store. I highly recommend that you have one of these in the wintertime. You plug one of these babies into the cigarette lighter in your car. And that way, if you do lose power, if you need to charge your phone or your computer or devices and things like that, it can be done. And of course, you know, I've been a MacBook guy for years. And so as far as this interview goes, I was thinking, how am I going to be able to pull this together? Well, the simplest way to do that from the Maverick podcasting perspective, that is to charge your battery on your computer. And that's the great thing about the MacBook. If you charge one, you'll get a good hour and a half to 2 hours probably of battery power if you can limit the amount of resources that the computer is using. You know, turn off all programs you aren't using. So in a stripped down, less than ideal circumstance like this, if you can keep your computer powered and you can use, for instance, your smartphone to access Skype via the 3G network, hypothetically, you could still do podcasts and have your guests on whether or not you have power. Now, that wouldn't be a comfortable situation. And of course, you know, dragging a Heil PR40 and an audio dongle that's powered off the computer itself, and then the computer, and then the smartphone all out into your car and trying to do a podcast. No, it's not going to sound great, but it can be done. That's the point. You know, I wrote that book, The Complete Guide to Maverick Podcasting, with these kind of things in mind. Because for me, it's not so much, what am I going to do if the power goes out and I still have shows I've got to produce? For me, it was a question of, well, if I want to travel, how can I get the best sound that I need when I'm traveling and I don't have my full studio at my fingertips, right here in front of me at my disposal? Because a lot of podcasters these days, they plug directly into a computer and they just go. They keep it really simple and stripped down. Well, I prefer having a little better quality audio than that. And so I've got a lot of outboard gear. I've got, you know, compressors, limiters, gates. I've got an actual board. I don't know very many podcasters these days who still use an actual mixing board. But again, this is a throwback to radio. And my bruds down there at Expanded Perspectives, Cam and Kyle, they still use a board. In fact, I think we use the same variety of Mackie board in our respective studios. But again, for me, when I was a producer in radio for a number of years, I mean, you had a full board, you had a phone hybrid. I've got one of those too, where I can take an actual landline and call people and route that through the board and then record that for interviews. And then, of course, all the computers and stuff. I won't get into all the gear. There's even more than that. But the point is, if you haven't got all that stuff and you've still got to sound good, the question becomes, what is the least that you can use to maintain good audio quality? So again, with travel in mind, I started looking into that and wrote a book that talks about everything from the studio side of it and what to build to how to do it on the cheap. I mean, if you don't have a whole lot of money or you don't plan to really try and be the next Joe Rogan or the next Adam Carolla or, you know, whoever else, and you just want to do a podcast for fun, how can you do it with as little gear as possible? I address every approach you could probably imagine to podcasting in that book, but when it really comes in handy, as I've found, is in the wintertime. If I've got work I've got to do, I'm snowed in and I don't know if I'm going to have power. And I've found a lot of quick ways to kind of be able to plan and still have a system that would work even under less than optimal circumstances. So I did all this planning, all this prep in advance of the snowpocalypse 2018. And you guessed it, the power never went out. That's right, I was snowed in, I had all this food. Hey, you know, I didn't go hungry. And we were able to do the show with no problem. Never lost internet, never lost power. All was well. And of course, as usual, I had a ton of work to do. So, still getting caught up, in fact. A lot to get to. And speaking of getting to the news, you know, Lauren, she was really concerned also. And from all the way down in Mississippi, she was sending messages. Did you lose power? Are you okay? Do you have everything that you need? Do you have milk, eggs, and bread? What is up with that, by the way? I mean, we were just laughing about that. And most of my friends and I do, but this is a big question. You know, why in the world is it milk, eggs, and bread? So let's say you go and you stock up on milk, eggs, and bread, as I have seen people do. My mom, in fact, saw a guy at the store. She called and told me that there was a guy at the store with 12 gallons of milk. Now, maybe he was buying it for all his family and his neighbors or something. Otherwise, I'm thinking, what are you going to do if you have all that milk and the power goes out? Are you going to sit it out in the snow? Are you going to sit around and drink milk all day? If you have no power and you can't cook, are you going to have raw egg and milk sandwiches on that bread? Milk, eggs, and bread. We've laughed about that for years. But sure enough, you go to the grocery store before any snow and the entire bread aisle, I mean, it looks like it has been looted. It is all gone. And my friends from up north, where it's more frequent to see snow in the wintertime, you know, they're used to driving in the snow. They're used to going to the store walking if they have to. And they're always laughing. They're like, you snow weenies, you guys, a little snow, you get a little sprinkling, 10 or 12 inches, and you guys lose it, right? So, now, again, not to say that there aren't some dangers associated with it. It's around this time of the year that we actually see a lot of dangers because especially people who may be in poor health or if they aren't well prepared and then a snow comes and surprises them, catches them off guard. They don't watch the Weather Channel very often. I mean, this can definitely be the time of the year that people are the most likely to be affected. And sure, that can even result in extreme cases in loss of life. So I want to remind you, by the way, here are seven quick ways, according to Farmers Insurance, that you can prepare for the wintertime. And it goes a lot further than just making sure you've got your eggs, your milk, and your bread. Okay, personally, I prefer canned soup and things that don't require a lot of preparation. Things that could be heated really simply with tea candles. Although, again, with the rig I was talking about with my car, running an extension cable from the vehicle itself and then using that to, for instance, power a little hot plate. I've actually got a hot plate too, so I wouldn't need the tea candles to try and heat my soup. But I digress. Now, here are some things that Farmers Insurance recommends. First and foremost, invest in weather stripping. And they say weather stripping is a good way to help seal warm air in and cold air out of your home. Because think about it, if you lose power, I mean, most of the time in the wintertime, if it's cold outside, you've got the heat on. Well, you'll realize really quickly if you have air that's leaking in or out, if you don't have a heat source indoors. Okay, and so you got to watch for your windows, your doors, vents and fans, plumbing areas, air conditioners, mail chutes, electrical and gas lines, all these areas are places that probably need to be insulated before winter arrives. Here's something that you usually only think about in the summertime, cleaning your gutters. Why in the world would you do that in the wintertime? Well, because if you've got clogged gutters and water can accumulate there, it's more prone to freeze in the wintertime, and that also can cause damage. That can even cause leaking into your house. The last thing you want is to be snowed in and also have a leak because you didn't get your gutters clean, right? In general, when we're talking about the gutter area and the roof, keep an eye on your roof and make sure that there aren't areas where ice dams can form. According to Farmers Insurance, while a roofing professional is cleaning the gutters, see if he or she can evaluate the roof for ice dams, too, because in cold weather, heat escaping your home can melt and refreeze ice and snow on your roof, and that's what causes those ice dams to form. Insulate your attic, ventilate your attic, too. If your attic wasn't built with a ventilation system already installed, contact a professional contractor. Get them to ventilate your attic before winter, okay? Because that allows cold air into the attic while the insulation seals heat in your living areas, and this can help prevent warm air from melting the ice on the roof like we were talking about there. Also, get a roof rake. That's going to help keep snow from building up. And again, if it snows enough and you had enough snow on your roof, I mean the actual weight of the snow with or without thawing and refreezing, that alone could cause problems. Again, if you're worried that you might lose power, something else you really need to do, and again, a lot of these things are counterintuitive because you're thinking you need to do them more in the summertime, right? But pruning trees and bushes around your house, especially trees with long gangly branches, because if there are long tree branches hanging near your house and it gets too cold and ice accumulates on those can take down power lines and then you will lose power, right? As far as food goes, do stock up on the basics. And that's kind of the funny thing to me about milk and eggs and bread. With maybe the exception of bread, which could last a little longer, these are kind of perishables, right? Now, they are basics. They can be used to make, I guess, French toast. But I mean, canned foods and things like that, food that doesn't require a whole lot of preparation and that doesn't need to be heated up so that it's safe to eat, those are the kind of things that I would recommend trying to get. But yeah, sure, if you like milk, eggs, and bread, or, you know, raw egg and milk sandwiches, that's cool too. And then, of course, this is maybe the most important. Make sure that you protect your pipes from freezing. There's a big misconception about that because a lot of people think if the pipes are prone to freeze in the wintertime, then we'll just turn the hot water on, right, and we'll let them drip. You don't even have to have hot water because the whole idea about your pipes dripping has more to do with keeping water moving through the pipes. It's more of a pressure kind of a thing. They say don't turn the heat down too much when you're out of the house also. Let the faucets drip during those serious cold snaps. That provides relief for your pipes. And like I said, even if it's cold water dripping, that's going to keep your pipes from freezing, or at very least it's going to make it less likely that they will. I have followed these procedures every year, every winter, for probably the last decade, and I've never had a problem, even if the power did go out. But by following these kind of procedures, you're able to stay warm, you're well fed, and if you're lucky, you won't lose power, and then you can keep doing podcasts like I do. And even if you do lose power, think about stocking up on gasoline, keep a little extra on hand, fill your tank up. Worst comes to worst, you can sleep in a nice warm car. You might want to crack those windows, though, because keep in mind, if the snow builds up and it blocks the tailpipe, there could be some problems, right? Okay, so anyway, enough about winter preparedness, although that does remind me, Lauren and I, we were talking about this, and she said with all the discussion about the snowpocalypse there in the Southeast, that had me thinking about people who have actually frozen to death. And we're not talking about people who didn't do winter prep like I have just outlined for you. We're talking about cryogenically frozen people, okay? And scienceofsingularity.com had an article about this recently, and here's what they had to say. They said corpse freezing hasn't exactly gone mainstream yet, but most people are now familiar with the concept. You lay out a ton of cash, you sign some papers, and spend a couple of post-death decades in a cutting-edge meat locker, calmly awaiting the conditions for your eventual revival. Would you do that? Would you ever consider having your body preserved so that you are clinically dead and frozen with the expectation, if there is ever technology in the future that could revive a person under those conditions, if they're well enough preserved, that you could wake up 300, 400, 500 years from now, and all of a sudden it is truly, as Aldous Huxley said, a brave new world? I don't know if I would do that. But apparently there are some who have. Over 300 cold dead Americans, or dead cold American brains at least, depending on which procedure they opted for, because there is the whole body resuscitation and then there is the brain only. So that could be even creepier. Let's say that you opt in for the brain only and you wake up 500 years from now and you look down and you're not the person you remembered yourself to be. Guys, I don't know. I haven't felt like myself lately. Well, apparently there are 300 Americans who have opted for one of these two, okay? All of them took a big gamble, one that was pretty cheap, metaphysically speaking. The worst case scenario here is, well, if you're dead, you just stay dead. But there's a greater likelihood that you will be able to be resuscitated and come back to life. So in other words, these are people who are technically dead, but who didn't want to die and may end up getting a new lease on life as a result of this gamble, right? I mean, if you think about it and you're willing to spend that money, what have you got to lose? Let's say that you're the kind of person who did want to do this kind of thing. And so if you have the money to spend, and if you're stingy and don't want to leave it to posterity, right, to your family, to friends, to civic organizations, whatever, if you've got the money to spend and you say, okay, so instead of cremation or something like that, where I know there's no chance of being brought back unless, you know, being born again in that tradition of reincarnation is actually a thing, and the theologians were right. I mean, if this is something that you're willing to gamble on, I mean, what have you got to lose? Because it's either I die and I've paid a bunch of money, which I'm not going to be able to take with me anyway if they can't bring me back. But if they can, it was a good investment, right? So, I mean, if you're dead, you stay dead. If it doesn't work, and if it does work, well, it was worth the gamble. So it's not really a gamble. It's just more, again, kind of an investment, a really different kind of life insurance. Now, we continue from scienceofsingularity.com here. They say, for the time being, it's also the only scenario, okay? Only time will tell whether these extremely dead optimists will once more someday get stuck in traffic and or roam an uncanny singularityscape with their AI-abetted computer brains. But at very least right now, we can talk with leading professionals and get a feel for whether it's something in the eventual sense that might work. And they cite a number of experts. And the first is Dr. Joao Pedro de Magalhães. He's a biologist at the University of Liverpool and also coordinator of the UK Cryonics and Cryptopreservation Research Network. And here is what he had to say. He says, I'd say that with today's technology, cryonics severely damages the body's cells, even under optimal conditions, and those would be that the procedure starts right after a person dies. There are several problems in cryonics. In particular, cryptoprotectant agents have toxic effects on human tissues with prolonged exposure. Vitrifying large organs like the brain can also result in fractures due to different cooling rates in different parts. Under non-optimal conditions, again, what we were just hearing about, those were optimal. Here is non-optimal conditions, okay? If a significant time elapses between death and the individual being crypto-preserved, then much more damage can occur because cells start to die. And brain cells in particular start to die within minutes after cardiac arrest occurs. And this is due to the lack of nutrients and oxygen. And therefore, due to all of the aforementioned, it's going to take huge advances in engineering and regenerative medicine, tissue engineering, to make crypto-preserved individuals alive and healthy again. So again, you know, one might argue that we really aren't to a point yet where preservation is truly worthwhile, because even in the act of preservation, you're going to see a bit of degradation of tissue cells. God knows what that does to brain function, right? In addition, he says, repair at the molecular level using nanotechnology is going to be necessary. And yet this remains in the realm of science fiction for right now. Now, that said, it is impossible to predict how technology is going to progress in the coming decades or centuries, and as such, I would say that the chances of crypto-preserved individuals even ever being revived is low, but it's not impossible. And then the argument is that the worst possible outcome of being crypto-preserved, like we said, is that you just remain dead. So cryonics gives you a chance of future revival that will not happen if you are buried or cremated. Moreover, he says, reversible and safe human cryptopreservation would be a revolutionary technology in the field of critical care. Patients with terminal diseases, including children, could opt to be placed on cryostasis until a cure was discovered. So in a sense, we could have an alternative to death, which has profound philosophical, ethical, and medical implications. Do you remember that show on Netflix? Some of you guys wrote in and told me to watch it, and I actually did watch some of it. It was called Altered Carbon. That was kind of the premise of this show, except they put this kind of futuristic spin on it, where not only are people being revived, not only do they sometimes find themselves in new bodies, but this is also something that involves a criminal justice system where people who have committed crimes will be put under, and then they may be revived after they have served their term, or they may be placed into a body for a certain purpose, like the protagonist on the program has been. So, I mean, a lot of interesting speculations arise from what is clearly at this point still science fiction. But one of the reasons that on the Graylian Report, really, I think now, but more so in the future, I want to look at science fiction and make it a pivotal part of what we do on this podcast is because for me, you know, when I started this show, it was more about the unexplained. However, as time has gone on, as you know, I've become a lot more skeptical and scientific in my approach. So that's the one side of it. But then there is the science fiction element, too. Many people enjoy science fiction because it is just that. It is fiction. Others, when you get real far out and start talking about, you know, colonization of Mars, you know, moon bases, you know, the search for extraterrestrial life and things like this, and all that outside the discussion of UFOs or anything like that, I mean, when we're talking about Elon Musk and you know, NASA and agencies, private or government, engaging in these very futuristic sounding endeavors, there are people of two camps who look at it. Those who say, well, this is the way to the future and it's eventual that these things will come to pass. And then there are the people who would look at it and say, ah, this is just science fiction. It has been. It always will be. We will never get to that point. I think I'm in that first camp, though. In fact, I'm sure I am. And I know that there are limitations to what humans can and will eventually achieve. I'm not saying that everything that's ever been written in science fiction is an eventuality. I mean, some of it truly is just fiction. But then you look at guys like Arthur C. Clarke. And I've mentioned this plenty of times in the past. I've actually done shows kind of themed loosely around Clarke and his 2001 A Space Odyssey. And that's not the only fiction he wrote where he predicted some pretty interesting things. No, he didn't predict that a monolith would show up on Earth or on a moon base or on Jupiter or anything like that. Despite the ancient alien-esque themes that appear in that writing, it's actually just the kind of innocuous little technologies that show up in stories like 2001. What appears to be a Skype call made from the moon base, Clavius. You know, things like that that we see. He did predict the creation of the telecommunications satellite. And we've played the audio soundbite in the past before, where Clarke is sitting there talking about computers and networks that will connect them in the future and allow people to stay in touch. And you know, he had that wonderful British accent. He would sit there, in the future, people will be able to connect with computers and they will talk to one another. You'll be able to get your news, you'll be able to see sports, you'll be able to see things happening in your world. You can talk to people who may just be waking up on the other side of the earth and it will be nighttime where you are. You know, watch those videos. Go on YouTube and look up the interviews with Arthur C. Clarke, where he is predicting the World Wide Web before it ever existed. I mean, he was mind-numbingly intelligent, but some of the stuff that he was able to predict, again, and wrote about in his science fiction, well, at the time it was written, it would have seemed just like science fiction. Nobody would have thought, oh, come on, in the future, that I can use a computer to talk to somebody on the other side of the world? Or to somebody in space? What have you been smoking, Arthur C. Clarke? But, I mean, it came to pass. It comes to fruition with time. And as I was ragging on Bill Nye the Science Guy recently for attacking Elon Musk and people who are interested in going to Mars, I mean, on the one side of that argument, I can totally understand. Let's look at what's going on this planet first. Let's try and make things better here. But there's something to be said for the forward thinking of guys like Musk who are saying, before it's too late, let's innovate technologies or find out whether it is even feasible to go to a planet like Mars. And let us see if we can get ourselves there and if we can create habitable conditions. No, we don't need to live on Mars right now. And so I get it. People like Bill and I are asking, why even bother? But if we can perfect the technology right now, and sure, there will be costs associated with that. Remember, the current prospective Martian colonization efforts are presumably a one-way ticket. That's not going to be probably something where those who are the first to go live there will easily be able to come back to Earth, if ever. So there are obviously opportunity costs and sacrifices that will be associated. But if we perfect the technology now, and if ever there is a situation where we need to be able to move people off planet for reasons existential or otherwise, then we have that capability. And as a friend of mine once said, he said, you know, I'm not really big on skepticism, and I'll tell you why. Because as an engineer, Micah, skepticism didn't get us to the moon. And quite obviously, skepticism isn't going to be what gets us to Mars either. But speaking of Mars, by the way, so there were some interesting things recorded by NASA's InSight lander recently. Okay, there was an instrument on board that spacecraft that was designed specifically for measuring the shaking of Mars quakes, since you can't call them earthquakes, right? If you're on Mars. And it picked up vibrations in the air. Now, you may, if you're not already wearing headphones as a podcast listener, you may want to don them for the next segment because we're going to hear a little of this haunting sound of wind. I don't know if we've actually ever heard the sound of wind on another planet. And again, this would have sounded like science fiction just a few decades ago. That a podcaster, whatever that meant decades ago, and his listening audience, is this like a radio broadcast or something? That they would gather together and kick back, don their headphones, and listen to the sound of wind on an alien world, as we're about to do right now. Thank you. So for many of us, myself included, this is probably our first experience hearing the sounds, not just seeing images from, but actually experiencing another sensory element from another world. I mean, that to me is truly fascinating. I'm sure as time goes on, we will experience more of those things with technology, with innovation, and with a little open-mindedness too. Okay, we've got more news to get to here when we return, and also some updates in the way of, well, there's an interesting hypothesis, but what does it have to do with things like cryptozoology? And then, of course, we're also going to look at some weird mythology from the British Isles. All that and more when we return here on the Graylian Report. So what was going on in the sky out over the Southwest? We'll find out here in a moment. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report, where we keep you company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com, our little home on the darkest corner of the web. Tyler Rogaway, we have talked about him quite a lot in the past on this show. I guess you might say I have my favorites. Arthur C. Clarke, he's one of them. Tyler Rogaway over at The Drive, he's really kind of captured the hearts of a lot of the UFO community, I think, because he is somebody who is credibly reporting on weird things going on in the sky. And this doesn't have anything to do with UFOs, by the way. This simply has to do with a military exercise that was underway out over the Southwest. And he said that his plane tracking friends, I'm sure he's got a lot of contacts out there, and we should get him on this show at some point. I've said this many times, but he says he's got plane tracking friends who started catching peculiar streams of Air Force cargo aircraft popping up on their flight tracking software on the date of December 9th, 2018. That was yesterday, in other words. And I don't know if they were using Flight Radar 24 or not. That's the app I use. I have that on my phone. They also have a website. You can track aircraft all over the world in almost real time. The thing is, though, I don't think that that applies to most military aircraft. So here is what they were reporting. He said, within a short amount of time yesterday, it was clear that a major exercise was underway. And the timing, he said, is perfect for this iteration of JFEX. That, by the way, in military speak, is Joint Forcible Entry Exercise. I'm presuming there's going to be a lot of explanations for the different acronyms and things here. He cites one guy who had posted on Twitter and said, looks like a conga line of 18 U.S. Air Force Hercs, that I believe, of course, is short for Hercules, in reference to a certain kind of aircraft. But Tyler says that at the same time last year, social media was flooded with videos of lights filling up the night skies, as strings of C-17s and C-130s crossed the U.S. on their way primarily to the Nellis Air Force Training Range. Actually, it's the Nellis Test and Training Range, so NTTR, there's another acronym, and that's in southern Nevada. He says, this unique Large Force Employment Exercise, or LFE, is among the most complex drills the U.S. Air Force executes, and it combines assets of all types, including fighters, surveillance aircraft, electronic warfare platforms, and throngs of ground troops and equipment that are dropped into or dropped off into simulated enemy territories. But he says, beyond being fantastic training for all involved, the exercise works as part of the capstone project for the graduating class of the U.S. Air Force's prestigious weapons school. The soon-to-be minted weapons instructors, also called target arms in some flying communities, put all their new and old knowledge to the test to successfully orchestrate what is among the most complex aerial combat ballets on the planet. So while I said this really didn't have to do with UFOs, if you think about it, it kind of does. And I'll tell you why. Because often on this program, people will see things and I'll get reports if there's been a meteor seen streaking through the sky or a military operation or an exercise or sometimes just a public display for entertainment like what happened in Nashville a few weeks back. And you guys often do a great job sending me information about things that you've seen, and then we have fun doing the detective work on the back end and trying to find out what it was. Now, I haven't received any emails about UFO sightings over the Southwest that occurred Sunday night, but I bet you I'm going to start getting a few, if I haven't already, so I'll have to check. It's always a good idea to have my emails open in some window or browser somewhere while I'm live on the air, because you never know what's going to come down the pipe, although I hate being distracted while I'm doing the show. So again, people you know will text me and call me and do all kinds of crazy things while I'm doing the show as if I can answer those. So if you haven't heard from me, it very well may be that I'm doing one of the many podcasts I produce each week. I fully expect I'll hear from some people who saw this training operation underway. And if you didn't email me yet, but it sounds like I'm describing what you may have seen, I'd still like to hear from you. info@micahanks.com, info@graylianreport.com. Might be interesting to see what this looked like from the ground level, so to speak. And speaking of things that were seen in the sky recently, here's another one that Lauren sent along, and there was some really interesting video attached with this, too, over Mexico. Some of our listeners a little further south may have seen the ultimate curtain raiser, as some called it. This was indeed a meteor streaking through the sky. It was burning brightly and green. They said this bright green fireball shot over Mexico in the early hours of Saturday morning, dazzling onlookers below. According to the report, the meteor was seen hurtling through the skies over Acapulco and also Mexico City. And according to some estimates, they said this thing was moving 20,000 kilometers per hour. So it was moving at a clip pretty quickly. This reminds me, though, again, of a bit of obscure information as it relates to UFOs, because back during the 1940s and early 1950s, right after the so-called UFO wave began, there were a lot of reports of what, you know, in a lot of cases probably were meteors. But it's interesting nonetheless, because some people had described bright green lights streaking through the sky that otherwise resembled meteors but didn't appear to be descending. They said that they were traveling along for long distances. They never dissipated or exploded or burn out like a meteor does. And these objects, which of course were called green fireballs due to their appearance, would be seen traveling great distances, generally following a horizontal trajectory. And Dr. Lincoln LaPaz had been one of the people who had sat in on a panel discussing these and talking about, again, a lot of data that they'd collected. They weren't sure if these were rockets or missiles. They were green. They kind of looked like meteors, but they seemed not to behave like typical meteors. And a pretty interesting report from back in around 1992 or 3 involved one of these things that was seen over Long Island Sound by a number of aircraft that were leaving New York and Boston at the time. And they all reported seeing this thing, and later a transcript of that sighting was released and obtained by Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. And I talked about that in my book, The Ghost Rockets. But again, the pilots, what they saw, they described as being bright green, moving very quickly at an altitude much higher than they were, and following what appeared to be a horizontal course. They were afraid that it was maybe a missile or a rocket of some kind, because they said it didn't just seem like a meteor streaking through the sky. Kind of makes you wonder, but whatever it was seen over Mexico last night, I guarantee was not one of the famous green fireballs from the early days of mythology. No, my friends, this in fact was merely a meteor. Oh, and that reminds me, I almost went to another segment without talking about NASA's Voyager 2, because, well, I guess in the words of concert promoters of days past, and Elvis aficionados will remember this, Elvis has left the building. Well, we can now say that NASA's Voyager has left the building, or at very least has entered interstellar space. And from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory there at the California Institute of Technology, this is what NASA had to say. They said, for the second time in history now, a human-made object has reached the space between the stars. NASA's Voyager 2 probe now has exited the heliosphere, the protective bubble of particles and magnetic fields that are created by the sun. Now, NASA says that comparing data from different instruments aboard the trailblazing spacecraft, mission scientists determined the probe crossed the outer edge of the heliosphere on November 5th. This boundary, called the heliopause, is where the tenuous hot solar wind meets the cold, dense interstellar medium. Well, we thought that wind on Mars sounded interesting. I'd just love to hear what the cold, dense interstellar medium sounds like, right? Now, its twin, Voyager 1, crossed this boundary back in 2012. It was big news back then, but Voyager 2, they say, carries a working instrument that will provide first-of-its-kind observations of the nature of this gateway into interstellar space. So, what Voyager 1 couldn't report back to us about its ongoing search beyond the infinite, Voyager 2 may be able to send some info back. In fact, it's now slightly more than 11 billion miles from Earth and still sending data. Think about that. Mission operators, they say, can still communicate with Voyager 2 as it enters this new phase of its journey, but information moving at the speed of light still takes about 16.5 hours to travel from the spacecraft back to the Earth. I mean, that's really not that bad if you think about it. 16.5 hours to travel from 18 billion kilometers away? I mean, that's actually pretty good. By comparison, I should note, light traveling from the sun takes about 8 minutes to reach Earth. So traveling at light speed, I guess we're doing pretty darn good, aren't we? Anyway, I'm going to leave it right there for the time being, and when we come back after this break, we'll pick up the conversation, because I want to talk a little bit about the null hypothesis. This is a great concept, really put into the context of a story that Adam Olson sent along, but it has to do with cryptozoology and why we can't rule out one of the most famous alleged cryptids said to exist by some out there in favor of this hypothesis. We'll talk about that when we return here on the Graylian Report. Company every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe by KGRARadio.com. I am Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. As always, glad to be here, although I guess it's a little cooler than usual. I mean, I guess this show's always kind of cool. We try to be, at least. A lot of snow above ground, formerly known as the icy plains of Asheville, similar to the icy fields of Hoth, I guess. Yeah. Because that snow's finally starting to melt off. By tomorrow, they're saying it's going to be back up into the 40s and back to business as usual. I guess I've got enough cabin fever for the time being, but a lot of eggs, milk, and bread to still consume here at home, right? I'm just kidding. I made chili, and I had a nice London broil in the crock pot, too. Those things are amazing. Indispensable. I forgot to add that earlier in the winter prep segment. Make sure you got a crock pot or a pressure cooker, something that you can plug into the wall, and it takes a few hours. You just, you know, you put it all in there, you leave it, and when you're done with all your podcasting, you have a delicious dinner ready to go, right? Other thing about Christmas time, sort of, is that I love the parsnips and the root vegetables that kind of have a wintry kind of a feel to them. Sweet potatoes, all those kind of things. Sometimes those go really nice with a roast as well. But anyway, enough culinary discussion. I want to move from the culinary to the cryptozoological, because Adam Olson sent me this interesting article recently. And it was posted at getpocket.com, but the question posed in the article is how the null hypothesis keeps the hairy hominid alive. Now, you know, it's interesting because I had referenced the idea of some British Isles folklore. And maybe I'll, in advance of something else I want to talk about here in a moment, I'll skip over to that subject, because there is a famous report that I love. And it was from this document called the Speculum Regale, okay, or the King's Mirror. And this was a document from, if memory serves, the middle 1100s. And it's interesting because it discusses certain places which presumably we thought weren't well known at that time, which certainly bespeaks the idea that people were getting around more than we thought that they were. And in a section in that document called The Natural Wonders of Ireland, an area which presumably was pretty well known at that time, it nonetheless talks about some interesting things. And the guys, the Seven Ages fellas and I, recently did an episode of the Seven Ages Audio Journal about the archaeological wonders of Ireland. But I had to touch on this report here because, again, it's always been kind of charming to me, and yet nonetheless interesting also. And this, again, from, well, this translation, okay, was published in 1917 by the New York American Scandinavian Foundation, but the translation was produced by Lawrence Marcellus Larson. His is my favorite. And this is the portion from that section on the natural wonders of Ireland that I love so much, in advance of our little crypto corner segment we're about to get to. So in this portion of the document, it says, it once happened in that country, and this seems indeed strange, that a living creature was caught in the forest, as to which no one could say definitely whether it was a man or some other animal, for no one could get a word from it to be sure that it understood human speech. It had the human shape, however, in every detail, both as to hands and face and feet, but the entire body was covered with hair, as the beasts are, and down the back it had a long, coarse mane, like that of a horse, which fell to both sides and trailed along the ground when the creature stooped in walking. Now, that story has always fascinated me because, again, mythological though we take that to be, it essentially describes a wild person or a Sasquatch, right? A medieval description of one of these things seen in Ireland. Now, maybe it's nothing more than myth. In fact, I mean, generally that's what scholars take that to be, but I'm fascinated by the prevalence of that mythology in all different parts of the world. And there's a very deep book, which it's a very heavy read, but I've mentioned it a few times in recent weeks because I've been, you know, really wading through that. It's called American Holocaust, and it talks about you know, what happens when European colonists arrive in the late 1400s in the New World. What happened to the indigenous populations? It's a difficult book to read. And of course, the Seven Ages guys and I are going to be doing a two-part podcast on that subject next year. But all that said, there's a portion in that book also that kind of talks about the European ideals, you know, the way that Christianity and these kind of bizarre ideas of purity and things like this influenced everything from, you know, self-mutilation for religious reasons and all this kind of stuff, the repression of sexuality, all these kind of things. But it also touches on the kind of romantic idea of humans having to go and travel into the forest, you know, and having to find a wild beast and the proliferation of descriptions of wild men and giants and monsters that exist in the remote wilds. And it gets into a lot of this stuff from a more anthropological and historical perspective. But whatever approach you take in looking at it, there are a lot of anthropological and philosophical questions that can be raised about the prevalence of, again, what I think you could call the wild person archetype. Now, again, all that's a little beyond the scope of the present conversation, but it sets the tone for this 2017 article from October of last year that Adam sent me by Carl Zimmer. And he notes, I recently got an email from an anthropologist commenting on a new report in the Proceedings of the Royal Society. And the topic of that report was Bigfoot, or rather a genetic analysis of hairs that people over the years have claimed belong to a giant, hairy, unidentified primate. Now, of course, he's referring to the Brian Sykes DNA analysis, and this was something that, although it didn't find Bigfoot at one point, claimed to have maybe found a unique kind of polar bear descendant or an animal similar to a polar bear in certain parts of the world. That also was met with skepticism. People in certain skeptical communities who were really far out on the skeptical side of things, I mean, they attacked Brian Sykes and said, you're an idiot for even trying to do science in relation to Bigfoot in the first place. And then people who are more out on the fringe camp were like, oh no, this is the greatest thing in the world, except for the fact that he didn't find anything. Try harder, you skeptic. And so, you know, the believer camp, they were calling Brian Sykes too skeptical. The skeptics were saying you're a wacko for even talking about Bigfoot, right? In other words, same stuff, different day. But in Zimmer's article, he says, the new paper will not go down in history as one of the great scientific studies of all time. I mean, it doesn't change the way we think about the natural world or about ourselves, but it does illustrate the counterintuitive way that modern science works. He said, people often think that the job of scientists is to prove a hypothesis is true. The existence of electrons, for example, or the ability of a drug to cure cancer. He said, but very often scientists do the reverse. They set out to disprove a hypothesis. And that's actually something we talk about a lot on this show, the test for falsification. This is something that has to be done with science. You don't, again, seek to prove, you try to disprove. If you have an idea, you work to disprove that, and therefore you have concluded that your hypothesis is null and void, right? So that's how good science, in other words, is supposed to work, and that's what Zimmer's talking about here. And he goes on to give a bit of a historical background as far as where the null hypothesis originated, and it was basically at an agricultural research station in England in the 1920s, where three scientists were taking a break for tea. One of them was statistician Ronald Fisher. He poured a cup and offered it to his colleague Muriel Bristol, and she declined it. She much preferred the taste of a cup in which the milk had been poured first. Well, Fisher said, nonsense, surely that makes no difference, but Bristol was adamant. She maintained she could tell the difference if the milk was poured into the cup before the tea was. So the third scientist was William Roach, and he suggested that they run an experiment. This may have actually been a moment of scientific flirtation. Roach and Bristol apparently married in 1923. Brief notes and asides here, but essentially he wanted to try and test this. So he says the simplest thing that Fisher and Roach could have done was pour a cup of tea out of her sight, hand it to her to sip, and then let her guess how it was prepared. Well, if Bristol got the answer right, however, that would not necessarily be proof that she had an eerie perception of how the tea was poured. No, with a 50% chance of being right, she might easily answer correctly just by chance alone. Several years later, in his 1935 book, The Design of Experiments, Fisher writes about this and described how to test such a claim. And here's how this would go. Instead of trying to prove that Bristol could tell the difference between the cups of tea, he would try to reject the hypothesis that her choices were random. We may speak of this hypothesis as, he said, the null hypothesis. The null hypothesis is never proved or established, but is possibly disproved in the course of experimentation. Every experiment may be said to exist only in order to give the facts a chance of disproving the null hypothesis. Fisher sketched out a way to reject the null hypothesis that Bristol's choices were random. He could prepare 8 cups, putting milk first into 4 of them, and then milk second into the other 4. He would scramble the cups into a random order and then offer them to Bristol to sip one at a time, And then she would take the cups that she thought were from the one camp, put those in one group by themselves and the others in the other group. So what does this all have to do with Bigfoot? Well, the point is that Bristol, they actually do this experiment and she passes with flying colors. She's able to tell which cups of tea were prepared in which way. And so she was right. She knew which was which, but they had had to prove this using a test that could rule out the chance of probability. In other words, that she would have a 50-50 chance of being right, even if she was just guessing. And so with this experiment, although they couldn't completely remove the chance that chance alone was a factor, they reduced the probability of chance being a factor. So in other words, he could have reduced the odds further by having Bristol drink more tea, but he could never reduce the chances that she was guessing completely to zero. Now, with all that in mind, we'll get back to Bigfoot at this point, and I'll return to Zimmer's article. He says, people have been claiming they've seen hairy humanoids for decades. Again, if we take into consideration some of the mythological accounts, which to me, in terms of the way they describe the so-called phenomena, are essentially no different from what we see today. And since many of the more skeptical persuasion would say that Bigfoot reports today are also mythology, that it's a modern myth, in other words, and that there's no reality to it. I mean, to that point, I would argue if we're going to say that past reports from hundreds of years ago and the modern ones are equally implausible and therefore purely mythological, if we can say that they're both mythological, then why can't we also say that if there was a shred of evidence to suggest that some of the modern reports were true, we could conversely look at past reports, and I mean centuries ago, like the Speculum Regale. Maybe those could be viewed in a historical context too. You follow me? Trying to apply logic here, it's all too easy to say this is purely mythology because it sounds like it's nonsense. And in truth, the King's Mirror, that document from the Middle Ages, was full of nonsense. It really was. So it's very difficult to cherry-pick something that seems slightly likely from a book full of all kinds of nonsense, like monstrous beasts, the Kraken, you know, creatures, skyships, all kinds of crazy stuff in that book, right? But the point is that there are plenty of other reports from other documents over the ages that describe Bigfoot-like phenomena. So if some people in certain camps want to say it's all, you know, make-believe, we could conversely say that if you're going to make the case for, in modern times, some of the reports being valid, some from the ancient past could also have a historical veracity to them. It stands to reason. It depends on really how you look at it, right? And the big question, of course, which remains is, well, what does the evidence say, okay? So Zimmer in his article says, again, that people who have been claiming they've been seeing humanoids of the hairy variety for decades, I would contend maybe there are reports going further back. He says they've offered up grainy photos, ambiguous casts of footprints, enigmatic clumps of hair, and in recent years, we've also seen attempts at trying to extract DNA from the hair, but scientists have dismissed these genetic studies because they didn't involve standard safeguards routinely used in such research. This is key. Bigfoot advocates have repeatedly claimed that professional scientists are willfully ignoring compelling evidence. The problem, in fact, is that advocates haven't been approaching the question of Bigfoot in a scientific fashion, Zimmer writes. So 2 years ago, again, Brian Sykes and his colleagues decided to run this scientific study of those hairs from the so-called anomalous primate samples. What ends up happening, of course, is they don't find any evidence of Bigfoot doing that. Okay? Now, the null hypothesis that was developed by Brian Sykes and his team was this. The hairs purported to come from Bigfoot or other similar creatures belong not to a previously unknown primate, but to known mammals. They extracted DNA fragments from 30 different hair samples and were able to isolate the same short stretch of DNA from each. They then compared that stretch to the corresponding stretch of DNA sequenced from many other living mammals, and the results that they found were very clear. The scientists found precise matches for all 30 samples that they looked at in previously known mammals. Does that mean that Brian Sykes and his colleagues proved that Bigfoot does not exist? I mean, many people said not only that that was the case, but that it was silly for him to do the study because we already knew Bigfoot didn't exist. Now, Carl Zimmer says, no, actually, it simply means that Sykes, unlike Fisher and his t-test, could not reject the null hypothesis. The question remains open, and if Bigfoot doesn't exist, always will. Now, of course, at the time that Zimmer wrote this, there was the pending discussion about this study because what Sykes and his team had said was that they had found some sort of an ancient polar bear or something similar to that, right? And the question had been raised, and Zimmer actually wrote in his article, it's possible that ancient polar bears and brown bears interbred, and some living bears in the Himalayas still carry a bit of that ancient polar bear DNA. He further notes some skeptics have offered up an alternative explanation for Sykes' finding. It's possible that the polar bear-like DNA actually comes from a living mammal, perhaps a brown bear, that happened to pick up a few mutations that created a false remembrance of the ancient polar bear DNA. Now, what we actually have, I think, according to subsequent studies that were carried out, which didn't find the same thing, is that that probably had just been an error in Sykes' studies, because similar analysis that was carried out in other studies after what Sykes determined didn't find the same thing. So to my satisfaction, the ancient polar bear theory was ruled out. But it's nonetheless interesting in the context of what we're talking about here because, and I'll leave you with this, Carl Zimmer said this about it, what the skeptics have done, in effect, is create a null hypothesis, and there's a straightforward way to set about disproving it. He suggested that scientists would need to find more DNA from those so-called mysterious bears that were believed to exist at that time. If other regions of the DNA also matched ancient polar bears, the scientists could reject the null hypothesis, and so science carries on one null hypothesis to another. I think that fundamentally the most important thing to remember, though, is that that is how science works, not saying from the outset the creature couldn't exist and therefore doesn't, and therefore you shouldn't do science that studies the possibility that Bigfoot might exist. If we're really going to be applying science to it, we've got to be open-minded as well as skeptical. All right, more when we return. It is The Graylian Report.
Is the Graylian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Graylian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
Keeping you company as always every Monday night from 6 to 8 p.m. East Coast time, worldwide around the globe via KGRARadio.com. I am Micah Hanks, proud and always happy to be here with you. Is your host of the Graylian Report. And thanks to all you guys out there who are keeping us warm here while it's frosty above ground. That's right, you guys have been doing so by providing your support in the form of Graylian X subscriptions. It's easy to do if you'd like to sign up and haven't done so already. Just head over to graylianreport.com/X, the letter X. You can sign up at $7 a month or $77 a year. And of course, that gets you additional weekly content, monthly specials. And of course, you have the satisfaction of knowing that you are getting a little something for showing your ongoing support of what we do here on the program. And if you're like me, if you're afraid you might get snowed in this winter and you don't know what you will do as cabin fever begins to set in, make sure, of course, at all times that you have the most important survival handbook, at least for podcasters, that you can afford with money. That is, of course, the complete guide to Maverick Podcasting, which is available there at my site, MicahHanks.com. And also, there's a whole site for that book, MaverickPodcasting.org, where you can get some additional information about that. But yeah, the Maverick Podcasting book will tell you everything you need to know about how to podcast in case you get snowed in. And trust me, that knowledge has come in handy over the last few days for me, as winter weather has ensued. What also comes in handy is hearing from folks like you out there, because you guys often send along really great information. And with time constraints last week, I didn't have time to be able to get to emails, so I want to touch on a few of those right now. Kenneth, leading the charge this week, writes, Micah, I am a fellow North Carolinian from the Piedmont, and I wanted to write to tell you the pure joy I get out of the Graylian Report. Well, thank you very much, Kenneth. He said, I have been an avid listener now for about 3 years and always greatly anticipate the latest episode of the podcast weekly. I do have a question, as I wasn't aware if you've ever looked into the claims of giant catfish around the Lake Lure area, and that's specifically the dam which has been rumored to have these catfish deep below. I've always been fascinated by that lake, mostly in part due to the town of Buffalo, which was flooded to create the lake, and still has existing structures deep down in the lake. My wife and I traveled there many times, and I even proposed on the lakeside gazebo near the beachfront. The famous Lake Lure Inn, which is over 100 years old, has plenty of high strangeness reports, which I'm sure you're aware of. I always enjoy when you give North Carolina history lessons on the show, and this is one that I love that encapsulates a bit of that mythical storytelling that many have claimed to be true. Keep up the fantastic work, and next time I'm in the Asheville area, I'd love to buy you a Guinness or a Dad Juice. Cheers, Kenneth. Well, thank you so much, Kenneth. And, you know, with regard to Lake Lure, I mean, that's not terribly far from where I live. It's about an hour and a half, maybe a little, no, I'm sorry, not an hour and a half, a half an hour, maybe a little more than that. And I recently visited Lake Lure. I hadn't been down there in a long time. And I just decided to drive up and then back down through the gorge and visit the little town. I went to the Lake Lure Inn, and they had a wedding going on there, and so the restaurant wasn't open. And I went to a little Italian restaurant overlooking the lake instead. But I hadn't been aware of the reports of giant catfish in that lake. And I've got to tell you, Dave Butler, my good pal down in Georgia, has sent along similar stories about other lakes throughout the Southeast. And the best I can tell, and by the way, this is not to say that people have not caught some monster catfish in their day, but the best I can tell is that the giant catfish idea is sort of a motif. There probably are some really large catfish, but again, iterations of this kind of urban legend will typically go something like this. A team of divers are exploring the wreckage or the remains of an old town in one of these, you know, little valleys that was flooded to make a man-made lake. And again, with the Tennessee Valley Authority and the, you know, production of electricity using hydroelectric dams and things like that earlier in the last century, I mean, this had been a regular thing where they would take these little communities, they would flood a valley, create a man-made lake that they could use as a source of power. And often these lakes end up being stocked with different kind of fish, and they become popular recreation sites and things like this. And to me, the real eerie stories that you'll hear involve people who they say on a particularly dry summer, if you're out on one of those lakes, sometimes you can be sailing along in a, you know, a fishing boat or something, and you'll see the tops of old buildings. How weird would that be, right? So you're sailing along and you see old buildings down below you. I mean, I don't know what it is about that that's just so eerie to me, although it does remind me of another story from the King's Mirror, the old medieval document we've been referencing throughout this show, and maybe I'll touch on that too here in a moment. But that said, Kenneth's story about Lake Lure, I mean, that's really interesting because Lake Lure is probably one of the nearer lakes of that kind to my home. And the fact that there are stories about these monster catfish in it doesn't surprise me because Lake Norman, which is a little further down the mountain toward Charlotte, also has those kind of stories associated with it too. And so the story, the general motif will be this, that divers will go down and they'll be exploring the ruins of one of these flooded towns. And then one of the divers will be shining their flashlight into one of these buildings and will see a catfish roughly the size of a Volkswagen. Okay, a Beetlebug Volkswagen. And you can imagine that would be kind of frightening, especially if it's a catfish presumably big enough to swallow a human whole. Although there are no stories that I've come across that involve people being attacked by said catfish. Now, for years, I've heard those stories, and they even have a name for the so-called water monster, which some believe to be one of those giant catfish as it relates to Lake Norman down the mountain here, and that is Normie. Kind of like Nessie with Loch Ness, they name Lake Norman's monster Normie. Got it. And that is kind of a motif, again, that you see with lake monsters. The naming convention typically is a pun that is based on the name of the lake itself. Lake Champlain in Canada has Champ. Yeah, we could go on down the list, but I think you understand where that's going. So, with regard to Normie, best I can tell, there is no monster living in a man-made lake outside of Charlotte. On the nearer side of the possible, of course, I had entertained ideas that maybe there were some large catfish, but like a lot of these urban legends, you start to see the catfish motif told about different lakes, not just in North Carolina, all throughout the Southeast, and kind of like ghost stories, where you will see common themes from different regions where essentially the same ghost story is told in different parts of the country or different parts of the world, but the names will have been changed or the locations of the incident are a little different. I even saw some of those mythological parallels to popular American folklore in some of the stories that Paul Ramosh told us last week when he joined us on the program. But, you know, however you want to look at it, I think that that's kind of how myth-making occurs. There's that storytelling element. And you take kind of a what would you call it, like a framework for a story where there are consistent elements to the story or the plot or the legend or the myth, and then you apply local names, local people, local, you know, lakes in the case of these giant catfish stories. Again, I wouldn't doubt that there are some pretty big catfish in Lake Norman or right on down the mountain here in Lake Lure. But it's interesting to me the fact that the stories of the giant catfish that cozy up at the base of the dam, it's always right around the base of the dam or in a flooded valley where there used to be a little town or something like that. To me, the fact that there's so much consistency to those kind of stories from instance to instance, lake to lake, town to town, it really points to the idea of a modern sort of mythology to me. So, Kenneth, that would be my take on it. But who knows, maybe if there's any place in Lake Lure that serves Guinness, we'll go down there and we'll just have to go look, right? And we'll have to bring some catfishing rigs too. Philip writes, "Hello, Micah. My name is Philip. I really enjoy listening to your podcast, yet get really annoyed when I disagree and cannot express my immediate opinionated rebuttal to your guests. But such is life. I think that what I love about your podcast is the way that it gets me thinking and so emotional. Anyhow, I just wanted to say in response to motif changing or having overlap, as he says, or how you don't have cases of aliens that look like aliens that are reported today. I'm drawing a blank here. I'm trying to remember which guest we would be referring to. Oh, this was probably during the conversation with Dr. Robert E. Bartholomew, the sociologist who came on the show. So for those listening, this was about 2 weeks ago. We had Dr. Bartholomew come on, give us kind of a skeptical perspective on UFOs. And so this was one of the points that was raised. And that's what I think Philip is talking about here. So anyway, he says, of course, yeah, you also don't have astronauts, gear, clothing, etc., as you did then. You also don't have people who wear bell bottoms or fly Zeppelins anymore. Just as the world changes in fashion and technology, wouldn't that also change with their society, presumably alien, right? Who knows, right? So if you don't know how, can you say it isn't so in their world? Hope I'm making sense. All I'm saying is, how can you justify that just because the types of reports in the past aren't still reported now as far as details, etc., would that make them not believable? I mean, what if aliens went back to their planet and reported how we look, and what they reported us wearing in the 50s, 60s, and 70s wouldn't be what we look like now, physically as well as a society? So would that mean that we didn't exist? Just a little food for thought, and what got me yelling my opinions at my speaker? Haha. I love your podcast and your views, so cheers, happy holidays, Philip from Germany. And thank you, Philip, for writing, and always good to hear from people in the international audience. Also, Mac writes, Micah, I just started listening to your podcast back in June on my hour-long drives to and from work, and you have the best voice I've heard in a long time. Well, thank you very much. Maybe it's my best trait, you know? I got one thing working for me, Mac, right? And he said, I wanted to thank you for the most recent podcast clarifying something for me. You mentioned that you woke and went out around 5:45 a.m. and noticed how bright Venus was. My wife and I were working shifts preparing our Thanksgiving dinner, and as I awoke to start my time in the kitchen, I took my dog out and saw this bright light. Now, to me, it looked as if it were moving, but I realized I was looking through tree branches, giving that impression. So I moved to another spot, and I saw it stationary. I had no clue as to what it was. It was big and bright, and you were right, it looked like a further moon or a closer star. Maybe you can clear another up. And again, he's talking about me referencing seeing Venus the other morning and how bright it is. I think that's a great way to describe it, like a further moon or a nearer star, right? But he said, maybe you can clear up another one. And this occurred last year on December 20th. With my dog in the same yard, no interference, I saw a bluish or reddish streak in the sky. Two distinct colors zoom by. Now, probably a second, but clear as day. Could it have been a meteor or the ISS flying by? Hope you can respond, Mac Ball from New Jersey. Well, Mac, that wouldn't have been the International Space Station if it were moving that quickly. My guess would be a meteor, but like we heard with regard to the recent sighting over Mexico City and Acapulco of the green meteor, meteors not only can be different colors, but can change colors too from time to time. And what that has to do with is the mineral composition of the rock in question. As it's burning, as it's coming through Earth's atmosphere, it is burning off minerals. And for example, I think nickel will burn green or blue sometimes. So what we could guess is that based on the greenish color of what was seen over Mexico recently, there was probably a high nickel content or maybe something else, potassium, who knows. I'd have to look at a chart. And at one point, I did actually do that. I looked up all the different kinds of things that might cause a meteor to burn different colors because I had a similar question. I'd seen blue meteors streaking through the sky. I'd seen some green ones. I've seen them burning bright pink or orange. I wanted to know what caused the different color variations. But to me, it sounds like what you saw was probably a meteor. The ISS, if you see the International Space Station, it's going to be moving kind of slow. It's going to look basically like a plane, but it's not going to have any blinking lights or any kind of red or green. And according to flight regulations, conventional aircraft have to have those red and green lights. That's why you see those on planes. You'll very easily be able to distinguish the International Space Station from those because it's going to be solid white. It's going to be looking like it's moving about the same speed as a typical plane, but again, just a solid white light. And depending on where it is in the sky as it passes over you, in other words, if it's not a good distance away where it's going to look like it's just making a straight line across the horizon, I mean, if it's going directly over you as it passes through the sky, and if it's just after sundown that you're seeing it, so that it's dark out, but the sun is just beyond the horizon, okay, and it's illuminating the ISS very brightly. I mean, once again, the International Space Station can very easily be mistaken for being a UFO under those circumstances because it's big, it's bright. It'll look brighter than Venus under those circumstances, but moving and moving silently. And so a lot of people, I'm sure, see that and go, what in the world am I looking at? And the first time that I ever really saw the ISS pass directly over my house under those kind of conditions where it was brightly illuminated, passing directly overhead, I was fooled. And the reason why is because there was an airplane somewhere nearby, and I could hear the engine from the aircraft and mistakenly associated that with the ISS. But I've talked about this several times on the show. There's an app that you can use called Sputnik that lets you know when the ISS will be passing through the sky near you, and so you can actually time it and know when it's going to appear. And with the help of that app and also friends of mine who are in the know, I was able to determine conclusively that what I had seen on that occasion was merely the ISS. But it had been quite an extraordinary sight to behold. So again, part of being able to determine what you see in the sky is knowing what things you can see and under what conditions they will appear. That's always helpful. So, Mac, I don't know. Hopefully that maybe will answer a couple of your questions there. Also, Steve writes, "Dear Mr. Hanks, big fan. I've debated whether or not to bother you with this, but I figured, what the heck? So, the sighting occurred roughly 3 summers ago in the small town of Ravensdale, Washington. It sits in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains southeast of Seattle. And just to set this up a bit, I lived on 5 acres with a panoramic view toward the mountains to the east. Although the property is off the beaten path, there are a couple of flight paths that go over or near it. One is for smaller planes, which traverses my line of sight from the northwest to southeast, approximately 5,000 feet in altitude and 2 miles out, and carries a fairly continuous stream of traffic. On this particular night, myself and two friends were hanging out on my deck looking at the stars and talking about who knows what, and I said something to the effect of, wouldn't it be cool to see a UFO? And within a minute or so, a plain white light appeared following the same flight path that I mentioned earlier. Now, normally, I would assume it would simply be an airplane, but something wasn't quite right. Its speed seemed correct, but it was quite a bit larger than the standard running light of a small plane. Not only that, but there were no red or green indicator lights flashing, no other lighting at all. Okay, so far, and I happen to know because I've read this email already, things get a little more interesting here in a moment, but so far I would say, if that were all that you had seen, that we're talking about the International Space Station again, as we described moments ago, right? Okay, Steve continues. So I pointed it out to the guys as we watched the craft started to slow down, and then it stopped. So the International Space Station is not going to stop in the sky. Now, there are some instances where, depending on how you're observing it, if it is passing directly overhead and you are facing the craft in the direction that it's passing, okay, it is possible that as it is going over the horizon off in the distance and you're standing in the same direct line of the path that it's following over the Earth, as it's going over the horizon, it will appear to stop. So we could still say the International Space Station up to this point, I think, depending on the angle that you're viewing it, right? Now, he says, it stopped, but then he said what happened next was stunning. After sitting motionless for a second or two, the light became brighter and without a sound or contrail, launched nearly straight up, and within 3 seconds was out of the atmosphere and disappearing into space. Okay, again, that would not be the International Space Station. I've tried my best to rationalize it. If indeed what you saw played out as you have described it for us here, Steve, that would not have been the International Space Station. That's quite interesting. He said, now, although this isn't the first UFO I've seen, it was by far the coolest, and there are only two possible conclusions that can be made here. And here are the hypotheses that Steve offers us. He says, humans have the capability to control gravity and are using that capability on a regular basis, one, or two, extraterrestrial technology exists here and now. I hope you've taken time to read my little story, and I'm sure my friends would corroborate it, by the way. Thanks, and always a fan, Steve Reinhardt. Well, Steve, thank you very much for taking time to share that story. That was a very good one. I certainly enjoyed it. I'm sure you guys out there did, too. If you have a similar story, I would love to hear from you. info@micahhanks.com. I got a bunch of reports from you guys about those triangle UFOs, and I'm still collecting some of those, and we talked about a few of them last week on the Gray Lane X podcast because I kind of did a special segment on that. But again, I would love to hear from more people who've had similar experiences like this, whether or not it involves something strange you saw in the sky. Personal experiences of any kind are always fun. James, my brother down the mountain, has done an exemplary job sending a number of stories like that, recounting his personal experiences from over the years. So anyway, I'm always interested to hear from you guys. info@micahhanks.com and info@graylianreport.com. Those are the ways to reach me. Before we go to break, I had said that the phenomenon of the flooded towns and people who describe sailing out over these lakes and seeing the remnants of the old buildings underwater reminded me of something kind of funny. I want to touch on that before we go to break, and then we'll come back and talk a bit about cattle mutilations. But in the King's Mirror, the old Norwegian document from the Middle Ages that I've talked about, here's another story, and this is the one that came to mind in relation to that. Now, in the portion talking about Ireland in that old document, there was the following account given. In the borough called Clena, there's a church, and one Sunday while the populace was at church hearing Mass, it happened that an anchor was dropped from the sky, and one of the flukes of the anchor got caught in the arch above the church door. The people all rushed out of the church and marveled much as their eyes followed the rope upward. They saw a ship with men on board floating before the anchor cable, and soon they saw a man leap overboard and dive down to the anchor as if to release it. Now remember, this is a ship that they see floating above the church in the sky. The anchor drops down and a guy swims through the air down to release the anchor. Now, they said that the movements of his hands and feet and all his actions appeared like those of a man swimming in the water. When he came down to the anchor, he tried to loosen it, but the people at once rushed up and tried to seize him. Well, the bishop was present, and when this happened, forbade his people to hold the man, for, said he, it might prove fatal as when one is held under water. As soon as the man was released, he hurried back to the ship, and when he was up, the crew cut the rope, and the ship sailed away out of sight. But the anchor has remained in the church since then as a testimony to this event. As you can imagine, I was fascinated by this, and stories like that have been interpreted by modern ufologists as being possibly a kind of crude retelling of a UFO sighting, where there were aspects of a boat or ship-like, you know, features that were attributed to the what they, again, through the lens of modernity, would have called an astronaut coming down and trying to untether his spacecraft from the side of the church. To me, I think it's probably just a mythology, okay, just an iteration of a legend, because that same story, yet again, kind of like the giant catfish stories, is attributed to a number of different locales. And I actually gave a UFO lecture in Leeds, England, a few years ago where I talked about that. And some of the, again, I find them very charming, those mythologies that share and incorporate those elements of stories from time to time from different places, but remarkably similar from case to case. And so the story of the man swimming through the air to release the anchor of his flying ship, it's probably one of those mythologies, but they're fun nonetheless. And again, the story of Lake Lure and Lake Norman and the, again, just imagine how eerie that would be seeing the buildings below the water. It kind of reminded me of that. All right, we'll be back with some cattle mutilations here on the Gray Lane Report. Broadcasting from the dark heart of Appalachia, I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. All right, let's travel back in time here for a moment, and in truth, we're going to go all the way back to the 1970s before it's all said and done, but for the moment, let's return to September 18th of this year. All right, Wendy Howell, writing for the Williams News, reported this in the Grand Canyon area. The headline, Cattle Mutilations Baffle Williams Rancher. These days, you don't see all that many cattle mutilation reports, but in the 1970s and up through the 1990s, they were fairly common. And you definitely still hear about them from time to time, but this is what Wendy wrote. John Mahon adjusts his well-worn cowboy hat as he leans against his dust-covered Jeep and points towards some juniper trees where, several days ago, he found two of his cattle mysteriously slaughtered. "I thought they'd been shot. I didn't realize what had happened," he said. "There were parts missing. They were mutilated. A cow and a bull were both killed overnight. An ear cut off, a section of the hide detached. The scrotum and penis carefully removed. The vaginal cavity gone. The blood drained. No discernible tracks were found near the carcasses, which were lying near an infrequently traveled road. Little blood was found on the ground, and the cow was wedged up into a tree as if trying to escape from something." In his decades of living in the scrubbly pinyon juniper forests north of Williams, the 66-year-old Mahan has tried horses and small herds of cattle and seen animals killed by predators such as mountain lions and coyotes. He has witnessed scavengers such as ravens and vultures picking up carrion, but never has witnessed the deliberate dismemberment that he saw last week. "For people to come out and purposely kill and mutilate an animal for their own pleasure is just unreal. It's sickening," he said as he tucked his weather-beaten hands into his well-worn pockets. Now, of course, what he said right there, "for people to come out and purposely kill and mutilate an animal for their own pleasure is just unreal. It's sickening." Pretty obviously not talking about aliens right there, is he? We continue. On September 8th, Mahon went out to his pasture 20 minutes north of Williams to round up his small herd of 15 cows, including an 18-month-old Angus bull, to begin branding. Now, this is key. The bull had not been seen since the previous Wednesday, and also missing was a pregnant cow. All right. With the alarm raised, Mahon and the other family members began searching for the missing cattle. Well, this was our first bull and our first cow. We were just getting started on building this herd. Well, after searching over the weekend, Mahon said that they were alerted by swarming birds and a putrid smell. September 10th that led to the dead bull, hidden from the main road in a maze of juniper trees. A few yards away from the bull was the dead cow, visible from an unmaintained road on the Mahon ranch. "I just assumed that they had been shot," he said. "I didn't realize what had happened to them until the inspector showed me. They didn't take any edible meat, just the genitals." I mean, what in the world? Well, Mahon discovered the dead cattle. He put a call to Arizona Livestock Inspector Royal Reedhead, who met Mahon the afternoon of September 11th there on the ranch. Reedhead lives nearby, and the cattle could be the latest in a string of strangely mutilated cattle that he had been investigating over 2 years that he's been on the job. So again, this fairly recently, this just within the last couple of years. And Reedhead said, "I know these people. I've been around this area for a really long time. I'm close friends with many of the ranchers out there." Using a metal detector, Reedhead looked for any sign of the shell casings or bullet fragments on the ground near these animals. He also noticed a few signs of scavenging. "These animals were killed by a drug. They were not killed by any kind of bullet," he said. "They were basically killed for their body parts." Reedhead said the lack of scavengers on the carcasses was a clue. "We found the cattle almost a week after they were dead, and not a single coyote, not a single bird, squirrel, chipmunk, or whatever had gotten near them. Animals that have any kind of bad toxins inside their blood and inside their meat, most predators won't touch them. Remember that. Remember that." Now, Reedhead said the cattle inspectors have been investigating these cattle mutilations for decades in Arizona, and he's investigated several of these kind of cases since he began the job back in 2016. In Flagstaff, the 90,000-acre Flying M Ranch reported similar-style mutilations on their cattle. In a 2016 Arizona Daily Sun article, Kit Metzger said her ranch had seen killings like this for nearly 30 years. "It seems that once they went public, the mutilations stopped," Reedhead said about the Flying M Ranch. Reedhead said that the cuts seen on the mutilated cattle in northern Arizona are precise. "The cuts on these animals are surgical cuts. I believe that the people are trained how to cut the organ and take the parts of these animals without hitting other organs or ruining what they're taking. They know what they're doing." Now, Reedhead said that most of the mutilation types of killings that he has seen are on smaller hobby farms and small ranches. "A lot of times on big ranches, the ranchers don't suspect this happening. These ranches are so big that they might not even find the missing animals, or when they are found, there's no evidence left." In other words, what he's saying is that if these things happen across the board, that on bigger ranches, the animal that goes missing is less likely to be noticed missing. On small ranches where people are keeping, you know, track of the animals and what livestock they do have, they're more likely to be noticed if they're gone, right? Now, apparently he says they die sometimes and you wonder what happened. Sometimes they get run over, there's lightning, and there are also poisonous weeds. Once the critters get to them, it can be hard to tell. Animals die sometimes, that's just the way it goes. But Reedhead believes that whoever mutilated and killed Mahon's cattle has a local connection. He said, "These cows haven't been here but 8 or 9 weeks. It took somebody who knew that they were in here to find them. these cows weren't advertised. You don't see them every day. There's so much vegetation that your visibility is 30 to 40 feet. Reedhead said that the value of the bull, cow, and unborn calf would have been close to $7,000, and he's asking for the public's help in solving that case. And further put it out that anyone with information about this incident or any other concerns about livestock in the area was asked to call Reedhead through the Arizona Department of Livestock Dispatch, and the number he gave was 623-445-0281. But I'll leave you this quote from Reedhead, and he said, "The people who are doing this to these animals, to these beef cows, are taking clothes off people's backs and food off their table, and that's a big hit." Remember, $7,000, right? Estimated cost, he said. "It's unreal, and it's sickening." Now, part of the problem I have with the whole cattle mutilation thing is the fact that there seem to be two interpretations that prevail. Okay, on either polarized extreme, there are the people who are UFO nuts who say, well, these cattle are being harvested and their reproductive organs used for some sort of extraterrestrial breeding program or something crazy like that. And one begins to ask how in the world UFOs even become associated with a subject like this, but that part at least is fairly easy to explain. There are anecdotal reports dating back to the 1970s that involve lights seen in the skies over some of these ranches, and some of the investigators on the scene, which we'll hear more from here in a moment, they have described what appears to be evidence that these animals were picked up and then that they were dropped. There's sign with some of the cattle that even though it is presumed that they were dead at the time they were dropped, that there were fractures, there's breaking of bones, there was bruising to the body, strongly indicative of the animals being carried, killed, and then dropped from the air, which causes the damage which is discovered when the mutilated body is found thereafter by ranchers and investigators. And so the kind of idea behind the UFO connection involves a lot of the little clues that have been found along the way with these mutilations. And of course, it seems more logical to say that, well, rather than a UFO picking these things up, that in likelihood a helicopter could do the job, right? But the problem, of course, is that in most of these cases, there are some cattle mutilation incidents where, yeah, helicopters have been associated with these mutilations. That absolutely does exist in the literature, but many times people will say that we didn't hear any helicopters, there was no evidence of anything else going on. Some people might have said they saw some lights out over the field, and then a cattle mutilation occurs. And so the insinuation that there are some kind of aircraft, you know, as yet identified or not, involved in all this. So I don't think it's crazy, the premise upon which the UFO narrative in relation to cattle mutilations was built. I see where it came from, but there's a lot of supposition involved. The question one must ask ourselves is, if we're talking about UFOs, let alone the sad conflagration of UFO and ET, which I'm always railing about. If you're going to talk about UFOs, talk about UFOs, but we don't have to try and say that UFO equals alien. We don't have proof of that per se. But many researchers who are all in on the alien idea, if they're seeing evidence that points to mysterious aircraft involved in some of these mutilations, of course they're going to say aliens. So on that one extreme, although there are obvious logical leaps involved, I can understand why people putting together the clues, ambiguous as they are, would be led to the idea of extraterrestrials mutilating cattle, okay? On the other side, there are the skeptics who, largely informed by their distaste for the so-called belief in extraterrestrials that we see in UFO circles, they appear to be more willing to say that a simple mundane explanation is all we need. These animals sometimes die. The removal of the soft organs and things can easily be explained by varmints. You know, foxes with shearing teeth could have cut these, you know, portions of the cows away very easily, and it might have looked like surgical precision. Insects and other things might have been eating these. And so what ends up happening is that on the skeptical side of things, an equally implausible explanation seems to be offered, which is that this is not a mystery. Sometimes cows just die, and then when you have scavengers move in and natural predation occurs on the corpses, the next day when the ranchers find it, of course it looks like somebody cut the cow up. But that's what happens when animals get to it before people do. No mystery here. And often, the skeptics will cite the FBI's own investigations into cattle mutilations and say, look, the FBI made the same determination. They note that there was never any good evidence found at the sites which indicated anything apart from simple predation by scavengers after these animals naturally died. And the problem with that, to me, is that because we're citing the FBI, and the FBI appears to be a very authoritative source, If they said that that's the case, then they must have been right, and therefore we can base our conclusions on the similarity to what the FBI concluded. But what did the FBI really do? Going back to the 1970s, around 1975, when a lot of these cases really kind of broke into the mainstream, there were a lot of reports of these, really kind of comes to a head around 1975, especially in the Southwest. But I mean, in a lot of states, this was occurring. And there was a memo that was sent by the special agent in charge of the Minnesota branch near Minneapolis and was writing to the Bureau and saying, look, we've looked into these things. We think maybe foxes were shearing them. But if you actually read and you go to FBI.gov and read the FBI's files on these cattle mutilations, I've even seen skeptics talk about this. Basically, their investigation amounted to collecting newspaper clippings because there were jurisdictional issues with them going in there and getting involved. And in addition to that, we also have the fact that the FBI, in a lot of instances, didn't seem to want to get involved, and so the investigations of the mutilations fell down to the state and the local, the municipal agencies, state police, you know, law enforcement agencies in those counties or those cities. And in the reports that you read from those investigations, you'll hear some of the investigators citing the fact that there were limited resources, lack of funding, lack of access to sophisticated laboratories where proper tests could be carried out. And so they saw what they thought was evidence of something far more complex than animals just dying and foxes and bugs going in there and chewing them up at night, but definitely never stepped over into the realm of ET abducting cattle to try and explain this. They said there's something more going on here, but we don't have the resources to be able to identify it. And whoever is behind this has almost unlimited resources. Now, I do want to offer a skeptical perspective before we look at some of the actual files from the investigations that were occurring in 1975 and the specific details that were being offered in relation to those. I know I also cite Skeptoid an awful lot on this program because there are times where they write things that, and they, because it's not always just Brian Dunning. The article that we're about to reference actually was by another author, but I do appreciate a lot of their perspectives on things. There are also times where I disagree. And I think that it's a great way, whether I use that site or any other site, to kind of compare and contrast belief among those who are very skeptical and think that they can explain, in all cases, all things. And to his credit, again, Brian Dunning doesn't always do that. With the lead masks case we covered a few weeks ago, he looked at it, he said it was bizarre, and he said, there isn't enough data. We can't, you know, pin the tail on this donkey. I don't know what happened. And I said, you know, kudos, man, because that's what a good skeptic does. You don't say that you know when you don't have the evidence. The problem is that if we don't have enough evidence to explain something, therefore we say there's nothing to explain. And I do see some skeptics do that. Believers, on the other hand, they enter often with this attitude that, well, no, this must be happening, and they go in looking for the clues that conform to what they already have presupposed is going on. Actually, in fairness, believers and skeptics both do that too. But it was Allison Hudson who wrote for Skeptoid back in 2015 about cattle mutilations, and just to share a couple of paragraphs from her article, she said, like so many of these topics, it's easy to get caught up in the individual claims of individual cases, that this corpse had some explained or rather unexplained markings, or that that case happened the day after black helicopters were spotted overhead, etc. But so many of those individual claims fall under the realm of anecdotal evidence, anomaly hunting, misreporting, or just plain arguments from ignorance. Unless and until believers can point to some consistent and persistent pattern of evidence across a series of alleged mutilations that is unexplained except via their culprit of choice, there's no sound reason to accept their hypothesis. I mean, I understand what she's saying. In other words, we can't say that, therefore, aliens, and that explains the entire cattle mutilation scenario. I don't think that's the case at all. I know Allison doesn't either. But nonetheless, I think that there are probably a variety of different explanations on a case-for-case basis. And that's essentially what she's saying. And she further says, and even if we allow that aliens or the Illuminati or whatever else is actually out there doing this, we're faced with the question of why. The answers are as varied as the culprits. If you believe the culprit is aliens, you assume some bizarre alien experiment. If your culprit is a cult, you assume the purpose is ritual and likely satanic. If you believe that it's the government, then they must be attempting to spread population-sickening prions. Every explanation fits equally well depending upon the assumption of the culprit suggests that none of the explanations is any better than the other. Nothing about the cattle mutilation phenomenon requires us to suppose an actual act of mutilation. Cattle die of natural causes, they decompose by natural methods, and sometimes they are scavenged in such a way that they look to those not used to seeing dead things as though they have been vivisected. Continued belief in active mutilation says more about the believers than it does about the world. And she loses me at that point. And here's the reason why, because she's absolutely right that we can't look at a single case and make a broad statement about this is what causes all mutilations. I get it. But by the same token, we can't explain some of the more bizarre cases as animal predation, because that seems like the most likely explanation across the board. And again, to me, it doesn't matter if you're a skeptic or if you're a believer. Both sides seem to kind of be doing the same thing. No, it's all explained simply by this. Insert your alien hypothesis, or you insert your scavenger hypothesis. And as far as the mention of aliens and Illuminati cults and satanic rites and rituals and all this nonsense, again, if you really want to try and make what you are arguing against seem like it is a silly idea, and therefore the people who look at alternatives apart from your conclusion that they are all silly too, all you have to do is assert that basically all of them believe it's aliens or cults or the Illuminati. Again, the rational investigators who have looked at the cattle mutilation, they don't think those things. There has been a lot of writing, however, in popular UFO literature that links the cattle mutilation cases to UFOs, and I can totally see that that's been damaging, and maybe that is the primary reason why skeptics make those assertions. But again, the skeptics fall into the same logical trap where they say if people are suggesting UFOs are somehow involved, they must mean it's extraterrestrials, right? That, again, I feel is a sad conflagration of two subjects that do not need to be associated. However, I think that people do make the association when it's convenient. Believers do it because it's more convenient to be able to explain their things in accordance with their pet theory that aliens are visiting Earth. And I'm sure some skeptics make that association when it is beneficial to them, if they can make that association and thereby make what they're arguing against sound absurd. So I can see the reasons that people do all these things, but if we get down to brass tacks and we look at the actual specific details about some of these cases, what do we actually learn? What do some of these cases indicate? Is there something more than simple death of cattle and predation that occurs thereafter, but something that could be explained in earthly terms without having to look at ET ideas? Well, I want to refer to some documents and an investigation that was underway in early 1975. And this was under the supervision of the Coryell County Deputy Sheriff and Department of Public Safety. And in early 1975, there in Texas, when this was underway, an incident occurred at a location called Copperas Cove, where the remains of a calf was discovered there. And it was bearing a lot of these kind of staple indicators of a mutilation. The sex organs had been bloodlessly removed with surgical precision. There were peculiar impressions found in the soil about 40 yards from the calf that formed concentric circles that were about 30 feet in diameter. Similar markings were found elsewhere in the same field, along with circular dispersals of dried grass, which appeared to have been depressed by some object, according to investigators, that looked like it was using tremendous force, along with the apparent removal of surface soil and stones in some areas. Now, DPS officials speculated that, again, this is key here, an aerial vehicle had been used in the operation, and this had been written by Timothy Good, who was a UFO researcher, and this in a book titled Alien Contact: Top Secret UFO Files Revealed. You can probably note the problem I would have with a title like that, but when this book was published back in the early 90s, it wasn't uncommon to see the synonymous usage of alien and UFO. I think really only in recent years has it been something that people like myself have made a point to try and argue that we need to distinguish between those two things. All right, the title of that book simply did not. However, there's some great data in the book, and Timothy Good actually is regarded by many as a really good UFO researcher, too. Now, the DPS officials, he wrote, speculated that an aerial vehicle had been used in the operation. It was later learned that several residents near Copperas Cove and Killeen had observed a yellowish-orange light hovering over the farmland at around the same time as the mutilation. Aspects of the investigations like what you just heard, again, are what I'm talking about. This is what contributes to the UFO narrative. Light seen, there are sightings of things. Investigators believed an aerial vehicle of some kind was used. And people, again, I think can let their imaginations get away from them, and they begin to fill in the blanks based on the sparse evidence that's related, and they leap to the UFO conclusion. Although, in fairness, one might say that even if it were a man-made vehicle, if there were some unusual or unconventional aerial vehicle involved, that by definition that would qualify as being a UFO, right? An unidentified flying object, not alien. So, as Good noted in relation to these Texas investigations, the FBI initially was pretty hesitant to become involved. And we, of course, do have memorandums that you can read at the FBI's site, which I've read, that show that agents in some regions were looking into the matter around that time. But the FBI basically was keeping a kind of low profile. And so in 1975, local law enforcement agencies were left to carry out most of the investigations. Now, in June of the following year, this is where Officer Gabriel Valdez of the New York State Police becomes involved, because on June 13th of that year, and at the ranch of a man named Manuel Gomez near Duke, New Mexico, FBI documents pertaining to that incident were later released by the agency and detail the incident that was investigated as follows. And I want you to pay close attention to some of the notes that were revealed in this FBI document. They said, at the scene, the rider, and this presumably is Valdez himself, examined carcass of a three-year-old black, white-faced cow, which was lying on its right side. The left ear, the tongue, the udder, and the rectum had been removed with what appeared to be a sharp, precise instrument. No traces of blood were left on the skin of the cow. Other evidence on the cow was a small puncture on the brisket. No other evidence was available as to cause of death. Investigations continued around the area and revealed that a suspected aircraft of some type had landed twice, leaving what were referred to as pod marks positioned in a triangular shape. The diameter of each pod part was 14 inches. The perimeter around the three pods was 16 and a half feet. Relatively small aircraft. At very least, the landing apparatus was triangular in shape. Okay, so they say emanating from the two landings were smaller triangular-shaped tripods, 26 inches apart and 4 inches in diameter. Investigation at the scene showed that these small tripods had followed the cow for approximately 600 feet. Tracks of the cow showed where she had struggled and fallen. The small tripod tracks were all around the cow. Keep in mind that in many of the skeptical determinations that have been made over the years, they explain these so-called tripod marks as being the burrows of things like gophers. Again, it's just rodents, guys. Holes made by rodents all around the dead cow. Okay. Other evidence showed that grass around those tripods as they followed the cow had been scorched. Probably also something rodents would do, right? Also, a yellow, oily substance was located in two places under the small tripods, presumably gopher barf, right? This substance was submitted to the state police lab. The lab was unable to detect the content of the substance. If it had been gopher vomit, probably you would have known, right? Easily discernible stuff. Well, the details given here are interesting, to say the least, and I'm fascinated with the idea of the tripod. But I'm also baffled by the fact that in an official FBI memorandum, one of the statements that's actually made was that there's no, data or no evidence of any use that's ever found at the sites where these mutilations occur. And I'm thinking, well, what do you call those pod marks? What do you call this substance that's located in the depressions that are left in the soil? I mean, maybe that's not valuable evidence, but it doesn't mean that there was none found. We continue, by the way. Let's go on to the later part of the report here. Okay, on June 17th, 1976, the rider, Mr. Valdez, contacted a Mr. Howard Burgess from Albuquerque, New Mexico, to proceed to the scene and conduct a radiation test. This was 3 days after the incident had occurred. His findings were that around the tripod marks and in the immediate tracks, the radiation level was twice the normal background reading. Radioactive gophers, I guess? Radioactive foxes that were, that were eating the remains of the cow after it died. But this is the interesting thing, too. Okay, Mr. Burgess's qualifications may be checked, the memo reads, as he is a retired scientist from Sandia Lab, Albuquerque. It is the opinion of this writer, Valdez wrote, that radiation findings are deliberately being left at the scene to confuse investigators. Now, that was a speculation on his part, but that's a really interesting speculation. He didn't say that the radiation, therefore, equaled aliens. He said, I think that the radiation that we're finding that was detectable at this site was being left to confuse us. Now, we could think about that in a variety of different capacities. I think it's really interesting. But nonetheless, so far we're not seeing the typical presumption that aliens were behind all this, right? But there were other really important clues that were obtained during Valdez's investigation, which Good recounted in his book. Officer Valdez noted that in all the cattle mutilations that had occurred in New Mexico and surrounding states at the time, the apparent object of the mutilations had been the lymph node system. And that's quite in contrast to the preoccupation many researchers seem to have on the removal of sexual organs and soft tissues exclusively. Valdez said that it seemed that the lymph node system, which would presumably have something to do with the immune system of said cattle, had been the emphasis, right? One of the weirdest things, though, that I found in relation to those investigations carried out by Valdez at that time, okay, and this, as he reported, only occurred in one instance, But this is what was in the report. He said a high dosage of atropine insecticide was analyzed in the blood system. And since atropine, Timothy Good commenting further on this, since atropine is a tranquilizing drug, this would imply that either government agents or private individuals were responsible in this case. Yet the presence of the drug need not necessarily be related to the mutilation, and investigations into later cases failed to confirm the presence of such drugs. Now, note again, by the way, that in the news article from September that we read out there into the Grand Canyon, the investigator with the state who's been looking into these mutilations talked about the fact that animals won't touch these bodies, that often the remains are left untouched, contrary to what people say about predation by scavengers, and that in fact it seems that there is some sort of a chemical agent present in some of the bodies which dissuades animals from feeding on the remains once the mutilation has occurred. Now, I was looking around to see if there were other additional cases where that atropine insecticide was reported in the bloodstream of some of these cattle, because again, as it was reported in that document that Timothy Good was citing in his book, they hadn't found it in subsequent cases. And Timothy Good seemed to be trying to draw attention away from the presence of the chemical, because he was saying that that would seem to point to a terrestrial source, but we didn't find that in all cases. The way I interpret that is that Timothy Good was more interested in cases where there had not been chemicals present, which had earthly connotations. But interestingly, Valdez later on complains in one of the documents pertaining to the investigation that we had such limited resources at times, the FBI wasn't getting involved, and it was frustrating because we had a real problem finding qualified labs that could help us make determinations about what may have killed these cattle and look for things like that. Now, Nick Redfern, who we've had on the show many times, good pal of mine from a number of years, he's written about this too, and I want to quote him here. He said, "What are the chances of aliens from some faraway galaxy utilizing atropine to sedate cattle before systematically butchering them? Personally, I'd say the chances are practically zero," and I agree. Again, this idea that guys who are interested in UFOs who look at cattle mutilations are saying extraterrestrials did it is bunk. I don't think that that's the case at all. I don't think Nick thinks that's the case. I further quote Nick talking about this case. He says, "In other words, while it is unlikely to satisfy those who desperately wish to believe that the mutilations are the work of bug-eyed aliens from distant worlds, the presence of atropine in a significant number of the reports, which seems to indicate that Nick found other cases where this had happened, coming out of the Dulce area suggests we may be looking at a definitively homegrown operation, but one that utilizes the alien motif as a convenient cover, focused on matters relative to biological warfare and perhaps concerns about such worrying and growing issues as mad cow disease, etc." Now, before we wrap up, because we're getting short on time, I want to leave you with one more thing that Burgess, Dr. Howard Burgess, found in his own investigation. Now, you'll remember, of course, he was a retired scientist from Sandia Laboratories. And after looking at some of these cases, something that he had written about, which Timothy Good noted in his book, was that he found splotches of fluorescent material, which they didn't identify as paint per se, but this not on the bodies of the mutilated cattle, but on some of the living cattle, which fit the general characteristics of those which later ended up being mutilated. And they actually said that this was only visible, this fluorescent material on the backs of these live cattle at these ranches using ultraviolet lights. I want to quote Burgess here. He said, "To our amazement, 3 4-year-old cows and 2 young heifers had bright fluorescent splotches on their backs or topsides, fitting the pattern of animal types being mutilated in that area at that period. No markings were found on their sides, underneath, or lower parts. We were not able to find any liquid or solid in the corral or pasture that glowed with the same color or brilliance as the marks on the animals. The fluorescent marking was not from material picked up locally. If the animals were marked in advance, how was it done, when, and by whom?" Now, again, I just want to quote, coming back to Officer Gabriel Valdez, and this is what he wrote in his actual report in light of all this. He said, "It is the writer's opinion that these animals have been marked for some time before they are mutilated. It is the writer's theory that these animals are picked up by aircraft, mutilated elsewhere, and returned and dropped from the aircraft. This is indicated from bruised marks and broken bones on the cattle. Identical mutilations have been taking place all over the Southwest. No eyewitness to these incidents have come forward. One has to admit that whoever is responsible for the mutilations is very well organized, with boundless technology and financing and secrecy." Now, what do you make of that? But again, I think that it's wrong to presume that researchers who have looked at this and who have found the kinds of things that we've outlined here, fluorescent materials on the backs of living cow, atropine insecticide in the bloodstream of those that were mutilated, you know, the hallmarks of an animal that was dropped after it was killed and mutilated from an aircraft, and of course the impressions in the ground which said aircraft may have left, that seemed to indicate not only chasing the animal around the pasture or area where it had been, but also which seems to indicate a struggle on behalf of the animal, as related in the report we read from September of this year. The animal up against the tree like it had been trying to get away. I mean, a lot of these features are quite consistent, and I don't think that they are easily explained by simple animal deaths and then predation that occurs thereafter, especially when you have chemical agents involved, fluorescent materials, etc. Again, to my way of thinking, it seems an awful lot to me like there's something more going on here and that we really need to look at the details to try and understand exactly what that means. But if we leap to conclusions, either on the side of skepticism or on the side favoring belief in extraterrestrials, we're doing ourselves no favors. I think that we really need to look very calmly, very soberly at these reports, but understand that there seems to be something more going on and that there is trace evidence of whatever that operation is, which is pretty disconcerting. It's kind of frightening in a lot of ways, but it just kind of goes to show that sometimes there is something more to be said about one of these subjects, but its association with fringe ideas and fringe beliefs and popular books and things like that can be sort of damaging. And I don't see the skeptics or the believers doing a very good job looking at what the actual evidence seems to point to. Now, that's going to have to be the final word for this week's edition of the Graylian Report. I'm your host, as always, Micah Hanks, and on behalf of all of us here at Team Graylian, Chris Hayes, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Jeremy London, Race and Robin Hobbs, Dick Oakley, John Anderson, Jason Pentrail, Tiffany Mack, James Waldo, the lovely assistant Lauren, the Graylian Reverend Matthew Oakley, and of course, yours truly, I remain Micah Hanks. We will catch you guys again next week on the Graylian, and in the meantime, as always, stay strange out there.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website, GraylianReport.com.